You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Archaeotech Podcast, episode 90. I'm your host, Chris Webster, with my co-host, Paul Zimmerman. Today we talk about getting your drone pilot certificate. Let's get to it. All right, Paul, welcome to the show. How's it going?
Pretty good, Chris. How are you doing today?
Not too bad. Still traveling and doing some things and working out the issues trying to get recorded. So if I sound different, I'm not in the studio. I'm in a bedroom of my mother-in-law and father-in-law's townhouse, I guess. And just hoping that this doesn't sound terrible and nothing weird happens during the recording because I can't control this environment.
Nice.
So let's see. I'm just going to put that caveat out there in case there's any weird noises and goings on. So anyway, what are we talking about today, Paul? You kind of brought this topic to us, so let's have you introduce it.
All right. So a couple episodes ago, episode 88 of this podcast, we interviewed Bill Whitehead. And you and Bill was very eloquent, had a lot of things to discuss. Mentioned kind of in passing a couple of times something called Part 107.
Yes.
And it was obvious in context that that was referring to some kind of drone license.
Mm-hmm.
But as I thought about it a little bit, it wasn't brought up explicitly, but drones, we're talking about it all the time. And you have quite a bit of experience and I have absolutely no experience with drones. I thought it might be interesting to kind of turn this around. They're really becoming a standard archaeological tool for a lot of projects. They're really cool. I mean, it's great fun every time you see one buzzing around. I have been in the recent past, got a little bit on the fence about how important they are, how useful they are, not denying at all how cool they are.
Mm-hmm.
But after listening to this Part 107 mentioned a few times in that interview, I thought, what exactly is that? And so I started to look it up a little bit, do a little bit of Googling and find out where I could take lessons and what that would involve me. And then I thought, this would actually just make a good episode to discuss with you how, if there's an archaeologist there who wants to go from zero to hero with this, how they'd start in on it and what are the steps, what are the goals, what are the things that they have to know and do in order to bring this into their toolkit.
Right.
And as a little bit of backstory to it, I mean, you mentioned plenty of times your aviation background, especially your activity with the Civil Air Patrol. Mm-hmm. I have an aviation background. I went to college initially to study aerospace engineering, and I used to fly. We've both done radio controlled airplanes. I think we've mentioned that on the podcast before.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never flown a drone. So given that, where do we go?
Well, I'll tell you right now, RC airplanes, a drone is kind of it's not a new term, but it's a new term in relation to these. And I think it's only because when these things, these aircraft started becoming sort of off the shelf, able to do certain maneuvers on their own. I think that's where the term drone came in, because the real term from the FAA and the government is UAS, unmanned aerial system.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because they need to be able to cover pretty much anything. But that puts, an unmanned aerial system, that is a kite, that is an RC airplane, an RC helicopter, a balloon, anything you put up in the air that no human is in is an unmanned, unpersoned is what they should have called it. But anyway, unmanned aerial system. And that's what, that's what that is. So when you look at your, and I think I want to start this off by talking about the Part 107, because that's going to be the make or break for whether or not you're doing this commercially. And let me step back just a little bit too, to say where this comes from. So first off, people call it a drone operator's license. I have a pilot's license, and I say pilot's license even knowing full well that it's incorrect to say that way, because it's not a license, it's a certificate. And that's kind of a different thing in government issuing. I've got a little card in my wallet, but it's a pilot's certificate. It's not actually a license. So your drone Part 107 is your Part 107 certificate. And that's kind of a little in the know sort of thing. People that go through the training, they should know that. But eventually everyone ends up just calling it a drone pilot's license or a pilot's license. I mean, I say that in common conversation because that's just how people say it. So anyway, now you know. So with any pilot's certificate, it used to be that you started with the private pilot's certificate, but now there's a recreational pilot certificate, which requires less hours or fewer hours and then fewer hours of flying time. It requires just about the same amount of ground school time, but fewer hours of flying time because it limits what you can do with a recreational pilot certificate. You can't fly at night typically. You can't fly in inclement weather, you know, stuff like that. And I think you've got a limitation on the weight of the aircraft too. And that's another thing when you're talking about pilot certificates is a lot of these things are based on the weight of the aircraft. So the FAA likes to base everything on basically weight, because if you go heavier in weight, you're going more horsepower on the engine and you're going probably higher altitudes and you're doing different things. And it's usually a good determiner of what kind of certificate or license that you're going to need. So anyway, your typical pilot's certificate, your private pilot's license, they call it, or private pilot certificate, will require, and I think for the rest of the time, I'm just going to call it a license because it just rolls right off the tongue that way. I'm not going to keep going back and forth. But anyway, the typical one, it requires a combination of ground school training and then flight training. And the amount of ground school training you get, there is a certain number of hours, like a minimum hours put on it. But the really important one is the flight training. And for private pilot, it's 40 hours, I believe, or 45 hours, I believe. And if you go to a professional collegiate program, they knock that down to 40. Because it's it's more consistent flight training. Mm-hmm. Now the drone pilot's certificate, from what I understand, because I got mine differently, but from what I understand, it doesn't actually require drone flying lessons. Like you don't have to technically know how to fly the thing. They just kind of trust that you're going to go up there and do that, because you're probably not going to kill 10,000 people. You know, you're not going to kill 100 people unless you fly the thing into the engine of like a commercial airliner, but the drone itself is not going to probably hurt too many people. So I think the flying portion is kind of taken out of it.
So is it just a written test, or is it a written and flying test?
Well, it depends on what you have. Okay. Like I said, there's no flying test. It's just a written test. So, but depending on what you do or what you have right now, if you have a current private pilot certificate, then you basically just need to go take the FAA written exam, and you have to go to an FAA examining location. You can find that online, but you have to go to take the FAA written exam and then take those passing test results to a certified or certificated flight instructor and have them basically verify, yes, you took this written for the drone class, and yes, you have a pilot certificate that's current. So bam, they sign you off and you mail that all off to the FAA and they send you your Part 107 certificate. And but if you don't currently have a private pilot certificate, or you have a private pilot certificate that's not current and they don't expire, but every 2 years, if you haven't flown, you have to have a biannual flight review. So you have to go up with an instructor. You have to do some ground training, go up an instructor, make sure they know what you're doing. And if you haven't flown in a long time, that could take, 10 hours worth of flying. You might have to go a few times before you really understand and get back into the swing of things. But if you haven't flown in like a year, maybe you can pick it back up in one flight and go like that. So once you have a current private, then you can, just take the test. And anybody can go, take the test if they want to. That's not a big deal. Whether or not you can do anything with it is the other question. Now, if you don't have the private pilot certificate, you have to take a ground course somewhere. And I think there might be some online ones, but most of them are in-person kind of things. And they're like a week's worth of training. You have to go there. You have to study. You have to do all the tests because what they want to make sure you know, and this is the kind of training you get with your grounds portion of your private pilot certificate, is you need to understand about airspace. You need to understand about weather. You need to understand about, aircraft weight limitations and what that means, basic flight characteristics, basic aerodynamics. Even though your typical quadcopter and like even the hexacopter and octocopter type stuff, they still operate like airplanes a little bit, but then again, not. It's like helicopters. Helicopters, when they fly, they're of course, acting like helicopters. But when you start going straight and level flight, and I've flown a helicopter one time in my life, but when you go straight and level flight, the thing ends up just flying just like an airplane. You pull up to go up, you push down to go down, left and right. You basically got your foot controls acting like a rudder, but it's running the tail rudder, and it operates very much like an airplane. But then when you slow down into hover, all of the physics change. and that's a similar thing with the drone. And if you've got one of the lower end drones without a GPS on it, which is hard to find these days, that drone's going to be drifting all over the place unless you trim it up. And if you don't understand things like what I mean by trim it up, then you could get into trouble. And you need to first make your aircraft stable when you're not touching the controls. If it's stable when you're not touching the controls, then you're going to be safer when you actually fly because your instinct when all hell breaks loose is to let go which you kind of should with one of these drones, is just let go of the controller, take your hand, take your fingers off of it, and then it should stop what it's doing and maintain steady hover. And if it's not doing that, then you've got serious problems. So now we're getting into flight characteristics. But did I answer some of your questions about Part 107?
A little bit. But let me back it up a bit, because you know, you and Bill had quipped about not yet having seen an advertisement, say, in Shovel Bumps for somebody with a Part 107 certificate in hand. Now, let's say we fast forward a few years. What would that Part 107 certificate give an archaeologist that he or she wouldn't have, you know, just going out to the Sharper Image and buying a Parrot drone or something?
Right.
What does that certificate actually grant you legally?
So, again, I will back this up slightly to mirror it to, you know, quote, normal aircraft or fixed wing aircraft, and or even helicopters. It doesn't matter, but heavier aircraft. So if you have a private pilot certificate, you can fly yourself, you can fly your family, you can do all kinds of stuff. But the minute your friend jumps in that plane and says, hey, can you fly me over to that the next town over and I'll buy you lunch? You just broke federal FAA regulations. And what that means is you can't fly, and this is the wording in the FAA regulations, you can't fly for compensation or hire without a commercial pilot's license. And compensation is where you really get into the weeds, because you can be compensated by, you know, somebody, you know, buying you a soda at the other end. I mean, that's compensation. That's them saying, here, you flew me to this place, I'm going to buy you a soda, and you just lost your pilot's license. So, you know, if the FAA happens to be watching that and they decide to be dicks about it and come over and check your license and find that you don't have a commercial, then you're gonna have to give back that soda. So, or give up your pilot's license. And that's where they get into a real sticking point. Now, I'm being a little bit facetious there. They're not gonna get too crazy about that, but that's kind of where that comes from. So Part 107 has been designed to do two things. One, again, like I said before, give somebody that knowledge that they wouldn't otherwise have of airspace, aerodynamics, weather, all that stuff, but also make them legal to fly commercially. So if you want to be paid to do any sort of drone flight, and you could be paid in just your hourly wage if you're an employee at a company and you're asked to go do some drone work, or you're a crew chief and you're asked to take, you know, still images up in the air with a cheap little pocket drone, that's for compensation or hire. You were hired to do that. It's part of your job description now. So you need to have the license. And since they couldn't, you know, they're just learning about all this, they're trying to figure out a way to make it not expensive for people to get into this and not overly paperwork heavy. Believe it or not, the government does do some good things to people. And I think the FAA does actually a pretty good job at not being too regulation heavy. But instead of doing a multi-tiered system like they have for heavier aircraft, it's just one. Having your Part 107 means that you've gone through all that training and you can now fly a drone, and it's up to a certain weight limit. And I'd have to look that up. I want to say it's 50 pounds or something like that. It's up to a certain weight limit. And then you have to get into other layers on it. But you can now fly a drone and you can do it for hire. You can be contracted out. If you go get your Part 107, it's a good side gig, actually, probably. You need to have the equipment for it. But if you have the equipment and you go get your Part 107, it could be a good side gig to go to CRM firms that haven't quite got into that yet and say, hey, I have my certificate. I know what's going on. If you guys want any limited drone work, you can hire me, you know, on a contract basis. So that's why you need that. That's what that means. And if somebody was to request that, that you be familiar with drones and be able to fly drones, you would need to have your Part 107. Now, there is a caveat to that, because they could start asking right now for drone pilots, because the other thing the Part 107 allows you to do is allows you to observe somebody. So you just need somebody with a Part 107 license standing there and watching you fly. So they're the ones that are responsible for that flight. If something goes wrong, or you fly too high, or you fly out of line of sight, because currently you have to maintain line of sight, and they're working on that too. But if you have to, you know, if you do something that's out of violation, it's the person with the Part 107 certificate that's actually on the hook for that. They're the ones that have to get the clearances from air traffic control if you need it. They're the ones that have to file the special paperwork if you need it. And they're the ones that are responsible completely for that flight. You're just the pilot.
Interesting. So in theory, you could have a crew chief with the 107 and somebody else that's piloting the drone, provided that crew chief is keeping a close eye on what's going on.
Yeah, and that's the great thing about it. Not everybody on the crew is going to need to be Part 107 certificated. Just one person has to be. As long as they're there, they can't stay back at the hotel room that day. If they do, you're not flying drones that day. But if they're out there, then anyone on the crew, as long as they know what the hell they're doing with the plane or with the aircraft, can fly it legally.
That's cool.
Yeah.
We'll get a little into, after the break, we can get a little more into some of the nitty gritty about how you do this. But you know, I've been in the field for quite a while and I've seen people try to use kites. I've figured out how I would try to use RC airplanes with cameras. I had a friend who did a successful project with a balloon and this gimbal that he designed, a robotic gimbal to hold the camera level. I've seen really kind of weird contraptions with large tripods or bipods to get a camera up high above an excavation unit to take photographs straight down.
Right.
And it seems that all these kind of Rube Goldberg contraptions have gone by the wayside in the last few years with the advent and ubiquity of drones. So let's say that, like me, you might have been a little bit on the fence about it before, but now see this as the quickest, easiest way to get good quality results with less hassle versus trying to do a DIY kite. Mind you, and there's some cool kite stuff there, but I think that a lot of drones are, or for a lot of purposes, drones are probably going to meet those needs quicker and easier than having to deal with all the vagaries of that having a kite-borne system. Now, maybe you know, you're in a place with heavy and consistent winds and kites are going to be the only real option versus a drone, but that's probably an edge case. So say you've come along for it and you really decide that you're going to go after that Part 107. You're going to learn how to fly drones. You're going to get into it. You're going to jump into it. And it's going to be one of the things that you're going to put on your CV for when you try to get those archaeological jobs. And I think that after the break, if we start in on a little discussion of how somebody would go from zero, that would be a good place to go.
All right, let's do that. And we'll take that break now and come back in a second.
All right, thanks.
Hey, podcast fans and digital archaeologists. Have you heard about WildNote? It's a data collection app that works online or offline on your smartphone or tablet, iOS or Android. It allows you to collect field data easily, manage data efficiently, and generate data reports and site records effortlessly. We have a growing list of state site forms built in for your use and some generic forms that will work anywhere. Check out the shovel testing and photograph forms. You can get a free all-access 30-day trial today by going to wildnoteapp.com. That's wildnoteapp.com for your free 30-day trial. This network is listener-supported. We're trying to move away from paid advertising while also creating new shows and supporting the ones we have. The APN has never and will never make a serious profit on our podcast. Every little dime we make goes back into the network and improving show quality. So become a member today at www.archpodnet.com/members to show your support, get some extras, and be a benefactor for archaeological education. Members get stickers, a coffee mug, a t-shirt, bonus content, early access to episodes, a private Slack team to talk to other members and the hosts, and full access to training on Team Black over at arccert.black. So check out our memberships at www.archpodnet.com/members today and support archaeological education. That's www.archpodnet.com/members. Now back to the show. All right, welcome back to episode 90 of the Archaeotech Podcast. And we are talking about drones again, but we're talking about really getting into nitty-gritty of what it's going to take for you to fly a drone. But Paul, before we go into what you should learn on, as you mentioned at the end of the last segment, you did mention kites briefly, and I want to talk about that because, you know, the bigger companies out there, the ones that can afford all the equipment, honestly, their aerial photography kit, much like your GPS kit, everybody probably has a Trimble, you probably have a bunch of Garmin eTrexes or something like that because you use the right tool for the right job. Do you need a $5,000 submeter GPS to take a general point of where you're at right now and look at your UTMs, and you know, you don't have to be accurate within a centimeter, 3 to 5 meters is okay, then you're going to use that little Garmin eTrex, right? So Same thing with your aerial photography platforms is you use the right tool for the right job. And generally, I think drones are going to be great for site overviews, like real site overviews, not these janky ones we take standing, you know, basically 5 to 6 feet off the ground, you know, where the camera is at our head height, and taking this expansive overview of a site, you know, from right there at the site boundary. You can't see anything in those. So taking those site overviews, taking photogrammetry sequences around buildings and structures and large features and stuff like that, drones are going to be perfect for that because you want them to go slow and take those images as they're pivoting around an object or something. That's something almost uniquely suited to a drone. You could do that with other aircraft, but a drone is just uniquely suited to that sort of task. Now, I'm also looking at drones for safety reasons, too. I work a lot in the American West in the Great Basin, and sometimes we've got slopes that look like they have a flattish kind of spot on top, but all sides are completely inaccessible or dangerous to climb. Like there's this scree slope that you could just get cut up on or fall down or something like that. So if we could just quickly send a drone up to the top to say, hey, what's up there? What does it look like? Is it worth getting up there? Is there anything we need to report? Then, you know, if not, then we're not going to waste the time doing that. Mm-hmm. Now, the other stuff like kites have a lot of applicability because there might be places where you can't actually get clearance from the FAA to fly your drone. Maybe it's just too sensitive of an area from an aircraft standpoint. Maybe you're working too close to a really busy airport. If you're in what's called Class B airspace, like Los Angeles or you know, Chicago or something like that, the chances of you getting the exclusion to fly your drone in that airspace near the airport is slim to none. Like they're probably just not going to allow it. Now, the chances of you getting to fly a kite there too are probably also slim. However, you can more than likely get away with that a little more and it will be less dangerous because of the strings on the kite break. It's just going to fall to the ground and nobody's going to get hurt. So that's something you can do. So kites are great for that. Kites are also great for traveling with because they're a lot lighter. Drones are a little better in some cases for those overviews that you're getting with the kite because you can literally just pull a small one out of your backpack and go, whereas a kite requires a lot of setup. Aircraft, we can talk about aircraft. So there's drone aircraft, which are basically, they're still calling those drones, but I mean, they can be any sort of power system you want. They're basically RC airplanes is what they are. And depending on what you have, electric, gas motor, something like that, they're generally going to be faster than drones. And obviously, they can't hover. They can fly pretty slow, but obviously, they can't hover. So anything where you have to cover large amounts of ground, like massive aerial survey, or you're flying some special equipment like LiDAR or something like that, which we'll get into later, then you're going to want the faster equipment that'll cover a lot more ground. So if you think about it, the quadcopter-style drone, quadcopter and any of the hovering style drones, you're going to want for smaller close in stuff, whereas the larger, faster stuff, you're going to want for bigger areas. So that's typically what you should look at when it comes down to what type of aircraft and what kind of platform you're going to use for your aerophotography. So, you know, you really got to decide what you're going to bring out into the field at any one point in time. But I think that should cover most questions related to the differences between those.
Okay, great. So, you know, obviously we do want the best tool for the job, and that's going to vary in a lot of situations. Now, like I said before, the drones look to be the best tool for many jobs for a lot of people. So let's say you're one of those people and you do want to jump in on learning how to fly a drone. What kind of drone should you first learn on? I mean, I keep on looking at like the things I work at a school and I see the mm-hmm. things that they bring into the robotics students, middle school students often, and they're little, you know, 5-inch across, 6-inch across things that they can fly in the room to teach the kids a little bit about controlling one. And that works great. Is that a reasonable place to start with those cheap, you know, $50 drones? Mm-hmm. Or do you really recommend that somebody start with something that's bigger, more expensive, has more capabilities?
You know, I've been going back and forth on that just a little bit because if you're going to fly drones professionally, and by professionally, I mean just like at work, it's almost like you really could just start on the big expensive drones, honestly, because they are so stable. You know, I've got this DJI Inspire Pro, and while I had flown smaller drones, and maybe that's influencing this, the thing is just like you hit the takeoff button and it hovers, raises the landing gear, and then it's just stupid stable flying that thing around, you know, and you can actually put it into beginner mode. You can reduce the tolerances, the speed limits, the altitude limits, all that stuff to make it so you could go full deflection on your control sticks and the thing is just barely moving one direction or another because you've set it down to those sorts of tolerances. So you really could, if need be, if your company has it and they're willing to teach you some flight characteristics a little bit, you could learn on one of those expensive drones. Now, that being said, if you're not working for anybody and have access to that type of equipment, but you're thinking about getting something and you're spending your own dime on a $1,000, you know, DJI Phantom, start with not the $50 drones, Paul. Start with the $20 drone into the gas station, right? I mean, start with the junky piece of crap little drone that has its own little controller. Don't get one of those iPhone ones right off the bat because I feel like those are more difficult to control. Get one of the ones that has its own little radio controller or infrared controller and just fly around the house. Don't ever take those little ones that fit in the palm of your hand. Don't ever take those outside. They're too light. A little gust of wind and it's just going to be blown into a tree or off into the street somewhere. So, you know, get one of those because that'll allow you to learn, you know, what does it mean when I move this left stick this way? It's, you know, what does yaw mean? How do I control that? How do I control the tilt of it? How do I go forward and backward and up and down? Because all the drones you're going to fly from that point on are going to have the same exact controls. Okay. Some of them might have some extra switches and some extra buttons, but your basic sticks that are under your thumbs, those are going to do the same things on every single drone. My DJI Inspire has, you know, it's a $5,000 drone, but it has the same control mechanism as the $25 drone I play around with and fly inside when I go to my Civil Air Patrol squadron. We've got two of those and we like dogfight in the conference room. and it's great because when that thing runs into your face, it's not going to poke your eye out. You know, it's not going to hurt. Well, it does hurt a little bit, but you know, you can. I've flown these things into the wall. You fly it into a column. You fly them into each other. The little plastic propellers fly off. They give you a little bag of them, you know, if you break them. And it's just low impact, low stress, low cost way to learn how to fly. And once you understand the flight characteristics of those, it's like swinging three bats before you go up. You know, that's really hard, but then it feels like one bat is light as a feather and you can get up there and swing it with all your might. Well, it's the same thing. Start with the absolute cheapest drone you can possibly find that has the four-axis controller, you know, forward, backward, left, right, up, down, and then yaw, which is spinning about its axis there. So that's what you need. You get that and you're good to go. And one quick comment on the iPhone control ones, which are pretty popular because the drone manufacturer can get away with not shipping you a controller. The only reason I say those can be more difficult, they basically work on the gyroscopes in your smartphone. I say iPhone, but they work on Android too. So you basically calibrate your device while you're holding it at a comfortable stance, and then you just tilt it, and the drone follows those tilting maneuvers. And you probably have some on-screen controls, and this is why I say they're more difficult sometimes, because there's no tactile feedback on those on-screen controls. So when you're pushing up with your thumb and not looking down at the screen, you could push right off of the control surface and then it basically resets itself, the controller does, back to center, or stays up depending on how robust they made their app. And you might not realize it before you can look down and take your eyes off the drone, which is always a big mistake. But if you look down to reset your fingers, you could crash in that amount of time and possibly do some damage to yourself and other property or people. So that's where we're going. Buy the cheapest one you can, but If your company's cool and they already have some high-end drones, they can probably pretty easily teach you how to fly those things because they're super simple once you really get used to it.
Cool. Well, here's another practical question then. You know, so I was looking on Amazon at you know, under $100 drones because I seem to recall you mentioning very inexpensive drones as being a good learning tool on a previous episode. And one term came up a lot that I wasn't entirely clear, and maybe you could explain. A lot of the drones say they fly in headless mode.
Mm.
I believe that has something to do with how the controls react relative to where you're standing to and the airplane or the aircraft is, as opposed to like if you're flying an old fixed wing radio control airplane. You're flying away from you and left is left and right is right. And then you're flying back to you and your sticks are crossed. Left is right, right is left, because it's always from the perspective of the aircraft. I think headless means that it's independent of that, but I'm not 100% sure. Are you aware of this, what this term means?
Not specifically, no, but I can tell you one thing. There's almost no way they could correct for that. If that drone turns around and is coming towards you, you better know how to cross control. because, and that's what that means. You better not cross control. You better understand what cross controlling is, because what that means is when it's flying towards you and you go left, the drone goes right. And if you think you're, and you just, your brain just can't work it out, you know, and it's just like, oh my God, what happened? And I'm not sure what they mean by the term headless, but I will tell you a few things that if you don't want to do that, there are a couple of ways. If you just can't learn that, there are a couple of ways around that. One of those is to, and actually you need this if you're doing some complicated flying, but one of those is to use the screen on the device that you're flying the drone with, because most drones these days, aside from the super cheap ones, have some kind of camera on them. And the camera is relaying back to an iPad, an iPhone, an Android tablet, you know, something mobile sitting on the controller, and if it's not the controller itself. And so the way you can avoid cross-controlling and those dangers is to just watch the camera. Now, the caveat to that is if you want to do things legally, you should also have somebody watching that drone, because you never want to take your eyes off the drone. The camera does not have full perspective on where you're at. You can't move your head around on most of these things and just like look around. And you can't really, you can't really see much around the edges. Like the DJI Inspire that I've got, it's got really good aspect ratio on the camera, but I've been up close and personal to trees before and didn't even know it when I was looking down at the camera, and the person I had spotting for me was like, "You're about to hit that tree." And I was like, "Really?" And I look up and I'm just about to hit a tree, but I can't see it in the camera. Because the camera's looking ahead and the aspect ratio wasn't side to side enough. Mm-hmm. And so that's one thing, is you always have a spotter, but you can, like I said, you can look through the camera. Or the other way that's really fancy is the goggles. If you get some sort of goggle system for your drone, then your drone could actually be controlled by the higher end ones. They can be controlled by your head movements. Once it gets into like straight flight mode. Yeah. You look down, the drone goes down. I can imagine that goes way wrong a lot of times, you know, like if you just like lose your orientation and your head starts spinning, or you lift the goggles off your head, what the hell's the drone going to do when you do that? You know? Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure what they mean by headless in that context, but at least may have answered some questions about orientation.
Well, you got into the things, some of my other questions here about camera. Is camera important for learning? And I would have assumed yes, but you were telling me about using a spotter. And so it seems like the camera really is for recording what's going down on the ground and what's going on around. But the visual contact with the, looking at the aircraft itself is the important bit for the control.
Yeah, no, when you're first learning, I would almost say don't get one with a camera, because you'll be so intrigued by what the camera has to show you that you won't be looking at the drone. And you need to understand and build that muscle memory for when I do this with my fingers, the drone does this. And you just need to understand that before you then, when we're learning how to instrument fly in a full-size airplane, when you're learning to fly on instruments, you actually have a blind that you put on your head that allows you to only see the instrument panel. And of course, you don't fly like that normally. You have a spotter, which is your flight instructor, sitting in the other seat. They're actually got their head outside the cockpit, but your head is inside the cockpit. And that's the terminology we use. So before you take your head from outside and looking at the drone to inside and just looking at the camera, you need to understand what that drone is. That way, when you're looking at the camera, you've got a spotter on the drone for safety. But when you're looking at the camera and you're saying, okay, I need to take a picture of this historic structure here, and I need to make this panning turn that's orbiting around while I'm spinning the camera at the same time, you can make the drone do those things while you're looking through the camera, even though you can't see the drone, because you understand the flight characteristics and you've got that muscle memory built in. So yeah, I would buy a cheap drone without a camera first if you're really interested in learning, because that camera is going to be a crutch early on and you're not going to really understand how that drone operates unless you can peel your eyes away from it. But it's so cool looking through the camera that you're not going to want to. So, you know, because it's neat seeing that perspective. It's a perspective you're not used to. And you're going to be real tempted to just look through the camera the whole time. And before you know it, you smashed into a wall, or worse yet, a person or a car or something like that. So, it's real dangerous.
Well, let's shift gears a little bit here then. We've been talking about cameras as equipment to hang from a drone, equipment mounted on a drone platform. But obviously, you know, that's the most common kind of equipment that we talk about, but it's not the only kind. And we've had discussions again back to back to the interview with Bill Whitehead, he was talking about LIDAR. You and I have mentioned that before. I know that there are other kinds of sensors that people are using in archaeological work mounted on drone platforms. What different kinds of sensors are there available now? And what have you used? What do you think is useful? What do you think might be coming around the bend?
I think just about anything out there that we have can be fitted onto a drone these days. It might take a slightly bigger drone because of the mounting system. That's really the limitation right now. It's not the equipment. It's how it mounts to the aircraft and how you can either remotely trigger it or have it interface with the aircraft's controls. So that's really the disconnect right there, because there isn't a universal mounting system yet for drones that they're all just adhering to, saying, oh, I can just buy this add-on piece of equipment at Best Buy or Amazon and throw it up on my drone. No, it doesn't work that way. So unless you buy something that is remotely triggering itself or on just a plan, like you just turn it on before you take off and now it's just firing and doing whatever it's going to do, then you can probably mount it to your drone somehow and go that way. But that being said, some of the types of things that people are doing is there's kind of smaller LIDAR with lower resolution, actually some with pretty decent resolution. And LIDAR is the stuff, you know, we've had a whole LIDAR episodes, but it's basically for seeing the ground surface through vegetation, to really simplify what LIDAR is. And it's a really great tool if you're in a heavy, dense vegetation, highly vegetated area, and you need to look at the ground and see what's going on. There's infrared for seeing, you know, heat signatures and spots, and that can be helpful in certain cases. There's obviously higher end cameras, like way high end cameras out there that shoot just amazing photography. And I think if you're going to do some sort of wide area survey with a drone, you're going to want a super awesome camera with a high speed video capability. I think, you know, like 120 frames per second kind of thing, just like really ratcheting it up there. So when you go into slow motion back in the office and you really slow that down to like normal speed, it's really high quality, amazing footage. Just like you see the slow motion stuff on movies and things. Those are shot with super high speed cameras. So you can get that clarity when it slows down. And so, yeah, I mean, really the sensors out there are almost unlimited on what you can get. You just need to, before you buy your sensor, look and see what drone it fits on. And you might have to go with some of those drone packages out there that where they're building sensors for it. Like Arc Aerial is a company that was set up just for archaeology and drone stuff. They're obviously doing some other things. I think they're based out of Texas or something. They're doing some other stuff, but you know, they were set up for archaeologists to use drone work. So they're building their own drones and they're buying these sensors and fitting them onto their drones, you know, with mounting software that and hardware that they've pioneered. So so that's pretty cool.
That's cool. We got a link to them in the show notes.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So
you mentioned, since we're talking about sensors, you'd mentioned a little while earlier about the overall weight of these unmanned vehicles and 50-pound limit. Assuming that that's the right limit, what kind of a drone and what kind of sensors would that be able to carry, and how long would that thing be able to stay aloft?
Now, again, this comes down to what kind of aircraft you're flying. You know, if you're looking at doing photogrammetry with a high-end camera, I mean, you could use basically any quadcopter, and the off-the-shelf DJI Inspire or even the DJI Phantom has a pretty good camera on it. So the right tool for the right job. You know, if it will take the images you need and you can download the right app to really set up a flight path and shoot your image set, then, you know, you can stay aloft for probably 12 to 15, 16 minutes on those drones on average. And it honestly doesn't really matter which size you have. What matters is the wind and the temperature outside, because all of those sort of off the shelf, out of the box drones like the DJI line, they get about the same battery life because the heavier ones, while they have bigger batteries, the drones are heavier, so they're fighting more for it. But these all have GPS on board, and the GPS takes a lot of power, and the GPS is what actually is your trim control. So you don't actually have trim control on these things. If it's drifting to the left, it's never going to do that unless you shut the GPS off. You know, it's going to stay in one spot because it's fighting whatever outside influences it has, whether that's unstable motors or wind conditions. It's fighting all of that to stay fixed on a GPS location, and that's how it maintains stability. So the more you have to make it fight itself, the less battery life you're going to get. And then, of course, the heavier you make it, the less battery life you're going to get. So if you need to do some big stuff like LIDAR and some wide area stuff, you're just going to need bigger aircraft, bigger drones. Now, even like the really big drones, if you got to pay $10,000 for a drone, but you're doing this a lot, I guarantee you that's cheaper than hiring somebody in an airplane and fitting a system to their aircraft or renting an aircraft or hiring one that has that system fitted on it. They're probably going to cost you $10,000 an hour just to rent it. So, you know, it is lower cost in the long run to go down the UAS route, no matter what you're doing. But you just got to look at, okay, what do I need? And what is the best combination of equipment to actually get this job done?
All right. Well, let me wrap this up then with just a simple question from you. And I'm sure it's not going to be that simple. But let's say, hypothetically, you had, say, I don't know, a podcast host that was pretty tech oriented. and he decided that he really wanted to get into drones, wanted to go for that Part 107 license. What would you recommend as entry-level professional gear, you know, not that $20 drone just to bash around inside to learn how to use a control, but something that one could seriously work an archaeological site or an archaeological survey with?
Honestly, I'd have to go with DJI on that. And you can get I think they're up to the DJI Phantom 4, maybe. That's the typical, like, smooth kind of white one that you see almost everywhere. The reason you see that everywhere is because they're really great drones. And I think the Phantom 4 has object avoidance now, which means you can run that thing full speed towards a wall and it will stop before it hits it. You know, it knows the wall is there. So it's going to stop. But you can get, because people are upgrading these things so fast, DJI upgrades their stuff just about as fast as Apple does. And in fact, I call them the Apple of drones just because they've got that sort of aesthetic. And also, they're a little bit more annoying in the fact that it's really hard to customize these things. Like, you can hack into them and do different things, but it's not going to work very well. If you're a hacker and a customizer and you want to run some code on their drones, do not buy DJI. But if you just want to buy an out-of-the-box system that is going to fly within, you know, well, I was going to say within 5 minutes, but really within like 2 hours of you getting it, because you're going to have to charge the batteries up. But if you want it to fly out of the box and be ready to go and just snap on the propellers and take the lens off the camera and say, let's do this thing, then DJI is the way to go, because you can get the Phantom 2s and Phantom 3s for, you know, a few hundred dollars as a full package online. You know, you can get them on eBay and Amazon and places like that, and just, you know, look on Craigslist. I would say if you get to go see it to pick it up, have them fly it. Make sure it flies. Make sure they haven't burned the motors up. Make sure they haven't burned the radio up. Make sure the batteries, you know, last longer than 3 seconds, because they didn't treat the batteries very well. These batteries are very particular, so you want to check all that stuff out, especially if you're buying used. But that's going to be the way to go, I think, if you think you're savvy enough and can fly these in an open area. Because again, they're complicated, and if you crash them, it's a really big mistake. Like, the propellers aren't cheap, and you know, you could burn up a motor. You could strip out a motor if you crashed into a wall. But that being said, they're really hard to crash if you're not stupid about it. You know, if you're not flying them in heavier wind speeds and in busy areas, and maybe you've got an extra spotter around there, because you are going to look down at the screen of your tablet or phone when you look through that camera, because it's really fun. So have a spotter and say, hey, you know, tell me if I'm getting close to anything, and just don't be stupid about it. I think you'd be just fine.
Good to know.
There you go. All right. Is that it on drones for now?
It is for now. There's a lot to chew on here. A lot that I learned today. So that's good. You answered a lot of my questions. Thanks.
Yeah, and I'm glad we got into this, because I hadn't thought about it when Bill was on a couple episodes ago, because we're talking about asking to see Part 107, you know, certificate in a Shovel Bones post. But really, you could just say drone pilot. You know, do you know how to fly a drone? Because if, like we said, I hadn't really thought about it till this episode, but man, if somebody's out there and they have the certificate, they don't necessarily need to be the pilot. You can divorce those two. And that's really awesome that you can do that. I think that's the best thing the FAA did for that was divorce the fact that you don't have to be a certificated pilot. You just have to have someone certificated out there. But if you're a pilot, a drone pilot, you can do it as long as you have an observer that does have the certificate. And that's the game changer, I think, right there. Okay, well, that is it. Let's take our final break and come back for the app of the day segment. Back in a second.
The Archaeology Podcast Network has partnered with T Public to bring you some awesome gear that looks good, promotes archaeology, and puts a few pennies in our pockets so you can get free podcasts. Check out our designs at arcpodnet.com/shop. That's arcpodnet.com/shop.
This network is listener supported.
We're trying to move away from paid advertising while also creating new shows and supporting the ones we have. The APN has never and will never make a serious profit on our podcast. Every little dime we make goes back into the network and improving show quality. So become a member today at www.arcpodnet.com/members to show your support, get some extras, and be a benefactor for archaeological education. Members get stickers, a coffee mug, a t-shirt, bonus content, early access to episodes, a private Slack team to talk to other members and the hosts, and full access to training on Team Black over at arccert.black. So check out our memberships at www.arcpodnet.com/members today and support archaeological education. That's www.arcpodnet.com/members. Now back to the show.
All right, welcome back to the Archaeotech Podcast, episode 90, all about drones. And for my app of the day, I'm going to keep the theme here and talk about an app called Before You Fly. And it's the letter B, the number 4, the letter U, and then FLY. And I currently have version 4.0.0. I have an iPhone 10. I'm not sure if their versioning is the same on Safari and Android. My guess is probably not. I mean, iOS and Android. But anyway, the iOS version is 4.0.0. So, but Before You Fly is an app from the Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA. And they have, this is specifically for unmanned aerial systems or drones. And right when you open the app, it knows your current location. And I'm sitting in Charlotte, North Carolina at my mother and father-in-law's place right now. And it says, warning, action required. You are within 5 miles of an airport. By law, you must notify the airport operator and the air traffic control tower if one is present of your flight. Again, this is if it's a commercial flight. If you're a non-commercial flight, legally, you're not supposed to fly over 400 feet high and you're not supposed to fly out of line of sight. So technically, if I abided by those regulations, I wouldn't be in their airspace anyway. You know, it wouldn't be a problem. Now, that's not the case necessarily, because if I was in a heavier, I don't know what Charlotte is. Is it class? It's not class B, I don't think. But anyway, if the class B airspace goes all the way to the ground within a certain distance of the airspace of the airport, so you could actually be in violation if you lived within that airspace. But it's asking me some data collection here. How high will you fly? How far will you fly? And how long will you fly here? And this is really just, they're not giving you any sort of clearance by putting in that information. They're just saying, you know, we're going to send this to the tower. And just so they're aware of what's going on. If you're required to have some sort of special regulation, then you'll know that, and they will know that, and they'll just be able to keep an eye out for a drone pilot in that area. If they've got a low-flying helicopter or something, or an aircraft on some sort of weird approach or in distress or something like that, they'll be like, you know, stay clear of possible drone activity, small aircraft drone activity in the area. And so they'll keep their eyes out for that, because obviously I'm not in radio contact with them, and most drone pilots are not either. So So that's the status screen. They also have a map screen, so you can just look at either your current location, or you can search another location, and you can see all the airspaces around you. And where I'm at in Charlotte right here, I'm within a little Venn diagram of airports, and I've got like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I've got 6 airspaces overlapping on my current location. So not a very safe place to fly, although I've got the window open because it's ridiculously hot in this room, and I haven't heard any aircraft flying overhead, and Charlotte is a pretty busy airport. So I think I'm just in the really spread out airspaces of some of these, and I'm right on the edge of a couple of them for some of the other local airports as well. So, but this at least gives you an idea of what you're going to be dealing with. You can set up a planner here for future flight info, so you can see if there's going to be any. These are things you learn about when you do your certificate, when you do your training. TFRs are like temporary flight restrictions. For example, an easy one to say is like the Super Bowl. There's always a TFR over the stadium for the Super Bowl because you're not allowed to fly over that for obvious reasons. But there's also TFRs for glider operations, because a lot of glider programs, they don't have radios inside there because of weight. So, or some sort of parachuting going on, you know, the parachuters don't have that, or the president's flying in, or some other high dignitary. There's always temporary flight restrictions around airports when the president's flying into that airport. And I see those notifications all the time because he goes to Vegas a lot. And every time he lands in Vegas and I'm up in Reno, I see the TFR come over the FAA as a push notification saying, hey, there's a TFR in the Vegas area, you know, watch yourself, basically. They don't restrict air traffic. They do. But they just make you hyper aware of the fact that something's going on there. And they don't always tell you, but they usually tell you that there is a TFR and you just got to kind of stay out of the way. So they'll put TFRs up over like forest fires because people want to fly drones and stuff over those. They want to fly in their own aircraft so they can go see it. But obviously there's firefighting aircraft up there and they don't want looky-loos checking it out. So anyway, this will help you, you know, see all that stuff and see what's going on. I can see the current list of U.S. airports, list of TFRs, list of national parks. You're not technically allowed to fly in a national park. You got to get a lot of permission to do that. Yeah. So you go camping and you're going to a national park. Don't expect to be able to fly your drone. There's even some best practices here, you know, guidelines for neighborly drone use, you know, things like that. So it used to be a really terrible application and it's pretty low featured. I mean, you know, the government got the lowest bidder to make this. So they wouldn't have got the, right. And I don't know who's maintaining it. Like if there's a maintenance contract on that, or if they just like, when it starts to break, they hire somebody else to fix it. I don't really know how that's working, but right now it seems to be doing exactly what it needs to do, which is basically just alert you to the airspace that's around you. And it's free. So I would say download it. And if you're thinking about flying a drone where you live or something like that, just see if there's any restrictions you need to be aware of. Again, when you're flying these small ones around your backyard or something like that, don't worry about it. Even if you're in the aircraft flight path, your drone probably can't even fly high enough to get in the way of those aircraft. But it is something you need to be conscious of if you're going to be flying that and flying it responsibly. So that's it for my app. And I think we'll move on to you, Paul.
Well, quick question. How long have you used this app?
I've had versions of it and then I've deleted it when it was total shit and then re-downloaded it again for probably the last 3 years or so, I guess.
All right. And it's been updated episodically since then a few times.
Yeah, they have to because it is from the FAA. So again, they don't say it's an official clearance or anything like that, but they do keep it updated because they know a lot of people rely on it for the airspace requirements.
All right. So you'd recommend this in the toolkit since it's free along with that first drone, that first DJI Phantom?
You know, it's free. It can't hurt getting it. So you can see the current stuff that's out there. It's probably the easiest way to see the current temporary flight restrictions and airspace out there, which are two of the most important things you're going to need to know at any level of drone flying proficiency. So yeah, I definitely recommend it.
All right. I'm going to switch gears a little bit here and pull a fast one on everybody. I don't actually have an app of the day. What I've got is a little bit of a cautionary tale, a very brief one that should be obvious, but wasn't immediately obvious to me, which is always mildly embarrassing, but I'm never too embarrassed to talk about the very obvious things that escape me because I work in tech all day long. And when the obvious things escape me, I know that they're escaping other people. So our last episode, episode 89, we were talking about Apple announcements and we spent quite a bit of time. I was talking about iOS 12 and how it ran on my quote unquote old slow iPhone 6. My old slow iPhone 6 is now my old dead iPhone 6.
Oh man.
Had nothing to do with iOS 12, had a lot to do with some family drama, the foot of my teenage daughter. And so, you know, I was expecting that I was going to go out in my, you know, another year maybe, and then buy the iPhone X XS or the XS Plus. But what I do is I've started buying my phones outright, not under contract. Right. And I do that because it gives you both the CDMA and the GSM antennas. So you can switch between Verizon and AT&T, for example. It means you're not tied into a contract with a particular provider. And so the phones provide that they're not, you know, utterly destroyed like my slow, now dead iPhone 6. They have a higher resale value. Mm-hmm. So for those reasons, the last two phones that we bought in our family, I purchased outright. However, I wasn't expecting to have to buy a new phone, not this quickly, and I don't actually have a whole lot of disposable income, so that Phantom 2 3 is also going to have to wait for a bit. And I went to the Apple store and I bought basically the cheapest decent phone that I could get, which was the iPhone 8. And I brought
iPhone
it home.
8, nice.
Yeah, it's very good. I like it. I didn't get the S. I didn't get the Plus. I was expecting I would. My coworkers have the Plus. I've got very large hands. I don't have any trouble using the larger size phone, But looking at it side by side in the store, I just said, you know what, I'll just go with the 8. It's virtually identical visibly to my iPhone 6. I wish I had the better camera that the bigger phones had or the newer phones. Mm-hmm. But this has a better camera than my 6 did. It actually fit the same case. Anyhow, so I took it home. I restored everything from my iCloud backup. It came through beautifully. I got all my apps. Everything was fine. I logged into the services. And what I've been finding out over the last week and a half is, I forgot to sign back into this service. I forgot to sign back into that service. So mm-hmm. I go to save something to Dropbox and I forgot to sign into the Dropbox app. So I go into, and today I found out that, I haven't gotten any of the Slack messages because sure enough, I hadn't logged back into Slack. And so my cautionary tale is that if you do upgrade your phone, regardless of how smoothly it goes, and mine went perfectly smoothly, make sure that you go back through all those messaging apps in particular of yours, the ones that you might rely on. If you know, for example, I've got family members that live abroad, so I occasionally use WhatsApp. I had mm-hmm. to sign into that separately. Like I said, Slack, I had to sign into separately. I had to one by one go through all these, and I didn't realize that for basically a week of using my phone. It wasn't until today when you and I logged into Slack wondering what we were going to do today. And you'd sent me a message this morning that I didn't get on my device. Anyhow, so that's a very simple little story for our listeners, is to make sure that on an upgrade, you go back through and make sure that every little piece that you rely on is up and running properly.
Yeah. And, you know, one thing I'd recommend along those lines is when you first get that new phone, before you sign into everything, go into the settings and into general. And this works on an iPhone. I'm sure it's somewhere on an Android phone as well. Go into general and change the name of your phone. Because the typical name of it, like Paul, if you're signed into iCloud, it's going to be Paul's iPhone, right? So, which is not that big a deal, but if you ever go back into one of your services, and I did this with Dropbox not too long ago, I mean, I've had like 15 different tablets attached to my Dropbox account because I had a bunch of work tablets at one point, you know, different tablets I've had over the years. And I always give the tablet a unique name. Mm-hmm. I don't let it tie to my iCloud name. So like, for example, when I got my iPhone 10, I don't leave my real name in there just because I like my screen name of ArchaeWebby. So I'll do ArchaeWebby X, and that's what my iPhone is, or ArchaeWebby 12.1, which is my big iPad, you know, something like that. And that way, like when I destroyed my iPhone 10 and stepped on it and crashed it into the concrete a few months ago and had to get a new one on the insurance plan, which I didn't know I bought, which was a lucky break for me. Otherwise, I don't know what I would have done, but because they are expensive. So, but anyway, when I got the new one, this is ArchaeWebby X2. And that way, when I go back through and clean up the devices that are attached to these different services, Dropbox says, you've authorized this device, this device, this device, this device. I can be like, yep, I don't own that anymore. I don't own that anymore. I don't own that. I know there's probably no chance that somebody is going to get a hold of my old phone at some point, boot it up, and then, you know, have all my login information. But either way, I go through and clean up those authorizations every once in a while. And I know which ones to do because they're not 15 of them that say Chris's iPhone. You know what I mean? So that's really handy. So I would definitely recommend changing the name in some way or another, adding something to it to specify the device, and going from there. So okay, well, I think that's about it for this week. Well, Paul gets into his new phone and signs into everything. I think we'll go and doesn't buy a drone, apparently. You know, maybe
my drone money is now my phone money.
nice. All right. Well, if you guys have any questions out there, please use the contact info on the website. We're interested to hear what you're doing, you know, what your struggles are with this, or any other recommendations you have about future apps or topics or people we should interview. Anything else, Paul, you think we should ask from our listeners?
No, lots of cash.
Send cash. Send cash right to my address. I'll be sure to give Paul at least 10% of that for his drone money. So, awesome. Nice. We'll add all the zeros to our paycheck for doing this. Yeah.
Beautiful.
All right. Well, again, thanks, everybody. And thanks for listening. And again, let us know what you think and what you want to hear next. All right. We'll see you later.
See ya. Thanks for listening to the ArchaeoTech Podcast. Links to items mentioned on the show are in the show notes at www.archpodnet.com/ArchaeoTech. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com and paul@lugal.com. Support the show by becoming a member at archpodnet.com/members. The music is a song called Off Road and is license free from Apple. Thanks for listening.
This show is produced and recorded by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, in Reno, Nevada, at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.